Okay, so the title of this book that I wrote, published 4 years ago, is The Misleading Mind, and that's what this workshop is it's about, but we do much more. I can go off in many directions, but that is the focus of this workshop. And the misleading mind, how we create our own problems, how Buddhist psychology can help us solve them. How many people didn't know there is even Buddhist psychology? Yeah, you can say. Yeah. I mean, most people think Buddhist religion, right? Okay, we're going to get into it. There is a psychology to it. The context. So then the context for the book was really my history. And I explained a little bit. So the people here the last couple nights, please forgive me because I'm going to give a little background on my... So you're going to hear it again. More extensively, I wanted to let people know that I did not like school. It's really important because people think that you have to be some sort of academic to study psychology and then study Buddhism, and you know, maybe you're academic. And school didn't resonate for me. I grew up outside Los Angeles. I was a product of the late 60s, early 70s. Did all those experimental things that people do today, when people did then. Of course, I was right in the hotbed of, you know, that culture. So, you know, drugs and all that sort of thing. I was telling Donna today that I was a high school student, a senior in high school, and I had heard about meditation, but there was no Buddhism, and like the Beatles were going to India, and Woodstock had happened with the opening with, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but with Satchidananda, remember, long flowing beard and orange robes opening Woodstock. And I guess I just had some sense of, I don't know, interest. Cause maybe from the drugs. It's probably from that. And, so I was really curious what that was all about and about meditation. I don't know why. I just thought meditation. Maybe because, you know, also I think when you're into getting high, then you're looking for new ways to get high. And then, you know, maybe meditation's a newer way. And I don't know what I was thinking. So in high school, I discovered there was a yoga class. And in those days, I really don't remember seeing anything about Buddhism. I think the little bit was around, but really not publicly. And so I went to this this yoga weekend. And then after that, I quit doing drugs, quit smoking cigarettes, quit eating meat, all those things, and I lost all my friends. Everyone was coming over to my house on Friday and Saturday nights, I thought, were my friends, right? And it's just I had the best weed, I think, in town. So I got very interested in that, and I got to the point where I was teaching yoga, and for a couple years, that's what I was doing, and I was really interested in that. And then I had a little bit of a falling out with the whole scene, which is another chapter of a book. It's very interesting because I think it's helpful sometimes for those of us who need to be more discriminating about our spiritual commitments. I think we don't know, you know, I don't know about now these days, but when at first this whole wave of spirituality was coming from the East, and they had lamas and swamis, and we really had this idea, there was sort of a mass cultural idea that they were really 100% pure, you could say. And it's, you know, well, we know it's not, it doesn't work quite like that, unfortunately. So a lot of people got hurt, and a lot of people got disenchanted, and things like that. It could happen. Not a lot, small part of the population. So that happened to me, and I didn't like school, as I told you, and I took a year off from high school and just kind of went around, tripped around, and then I wanted to take another year off, right? And I mentioned to my mom, I think I'll take another year off, and she said, no, you promised you'd go to college. And she was right, I had promised. And she was very kind, and she had found this college up in Olympia, Washington, one of two alternative type colleges, Evergreen State College. Many people have heard of it now. And in my third year there, even there was a year in Nepal program. And I thought, Nepal, This is 1975, or 74, 75. I thought Nepal, how many people who were around back then knew where Nepal was in 1975? Anybody? I didn't know where it was. Oh, kind of. You knew it was kind of that general area. So I looked on a map and I thought, oh, there it is. I can sneak across to India and find my guru. Because that was what you would do. And it's really close. And so I joined up for that Nepal. I almost didn't go because I'd had this falling out with that tradition, the yoga tradition I've been involved in. And my advisor said, why don't you go to Nepal and do a study on authentic Hinduism? Because Nepal is a Hindu capital, kingdom, and versus what's happening here in the States. Well, sounds good. I mean, I wasn't interested in that, actually. But I said, okay, I wanted to go on this program. And I was there. We did, you know, intensive Nepalese language, lived in villages with families in the village. And I was getting more and more behind on my projects. I loved the country. Loved what was going on. It was really very, exotic. So I was getting later and later, and I started to panic about this thesis I had to do. And so someone said, why don't you go? There's a monastery on this hill over. I could see the monastery from the village I was living in. You know, they hold meditation courses up there. And then I looked into it a little bit, and I found out, well, I'm not going to go there. Anybody know why I didn't want to go there? I think I told you, Donna, today, didn't I? No. Because I was authentic Nepalese guy. I wasn't going with a bunch of tourists go, right? That's where the tourists, the Dharma, you know, bums and people and trippers, you know, hippies go up there. And I don't want to hang out with, you know, I don't belong there. And so I had a panic. I did go because I had to do this research project. Thank God I went there. My arrogance didn't destroy that. So the 1 month meditation course, the Kopan, of which this is one of now outgrowth. When I first went, I think there weren't any centers. And now we have over 160 centers that all came from there. Because people, Western foreign people, would come to Kopan for the 1 month meditation course. So if you wanted to study Buddhism, you didn't have many options. You either did it at Kopan, because the two lamas spoke English, or you went to Dharamsala, India, where the only Dalai Lama's government in exile is, and there was a Tibetan library there where they also had teachings for foreigners, Westerners. You know, they were translated into English, or some of the lamas spoke some English, I think. So I went to Kopan, and this is the Year in Nepal program, and essentially I left like 14 years later. I did leave a year and a half later, because I had to finish that degree. I had one more semester. And I also had, at that point, when that year and a half I was at Kopan, I started teaching the young monks English. Didn't know what I was doing, but, you know, they asked me to teach English. I started teaching English. And so that's how I ended up back there. It's a story which I told last night. I don't think I'll tell it now. Because I'm going to get too long-winded. But essentially, the head lama, which is lama... Well, I'll tell you, because it matters. Okay. So, two lamas in charge there. Lama Tupten Yeshe. Do we have a picture of him? It's behind the... Just, but he's behind the screen, right? Yeah. You can see him. Yeah. Is there another one besides this, or is this one you're seeing? Okay, because I think people on this side can't see it, right? Yeah. Visualize. Lama Tupten Yeshe and then his protege, Lama Zopa Rinpoche. So Lama Yeshe, I will tell you stories about him because he's a very significant figure in the work that I do, and I don't want you to think that anything that I share with you that's a benefit, I mean, not, it sounds kind of false humility, and it probably is, but, you know, really I receive from Lama Yeshe, I have to say, and then, of course, Lama Zopa Rinpoche. So, Lama Yeshe, I will share different stories with you, with him, and Lama Zopa Rinpoche. And so Lama Yeshe was a very unique figure in many people's lives. He was a unique figure anyway. He was very unique in the sense that a very special being. And what made his, one of the qualities he had, he had a huge commitment to communicate with anybody. And he did. I mean, my parents loved him. My parents, not Buddhists, you know, they loved him. Everyone connected with him. He had this unbelievable quality. And that was one thing. The other thing was, when you met him, he seemed really sort of the embodiment of hope. And I'd have to say warmth and affection, love, like you've never met before. I mean, sometimes we say like your favorite uncle, you know, but it was more than that. You know, it was like he was right there. He really could get you. And that's why I think, as we talk, you know, the quality of these, of this psychology. He embodied, as does Lama Zopram Shay, but Lama embodied that psychology. And what he chose to do was he wanted to embody it and get you to feel or experience it. Do you know what I mean? So he really kind of opened the door a little more than typical lamas might, until you know them quite well. People had this feeling that there is something remarkable, something different about this man. And so he was a visionary. We'll talk about that more, but he's an extreme visionary. And Ravi, were you there in those days?
I went in 81.
El Salam was there, yeah. Okay. I think, are you the only one here that, besides me, that met Lama Yeshe? Okay. So if you have things to add to what I'm saying, please, feel free. Lama Yeshe passed away in 1984. Maybe we'll talk about that at some point. So, Lama Yeshe, as I described, was extremely, like I said, I mean, he's jovial. He was kind of extroverted and just a remarkable human being. You can see some old videotape of him. I suggest you do if you're interested in it. It does communicate his quality and his style. And his style of teaching was also unique. And I'll talk about that in a minute. But anyway, my relationship with Lama Yeshe was a bit different. My relationship with Lama Yeshe was, fortunately, very difficult, I would say. Difficult in many ways. Trungpa Rinpoche says, the purpose of the guru is to insult you. I must have been really a bad something. Because I got a lot of insults. I only remember one compliment he ever gave me, and I'll tell you that later when it's more relevant. But only one after 8 years of working with him. And so, which I'm not saying it's a criticism. I mean, it's just very hard. It's very tough. You know, tough love. I say tough, indefinite love. Okay. So I used to get quite intimidated by him, as would all the young. Traditionally, you know, a lot of times it happens in the monasteries, the monks will get intimidated by very high lamas. We don't see that here, but if you go to the monastery, they're around, you know, certain very high lamas, you know, like they'll scatter or they'll become very demure, and you know, they feel intimidated by their energy or their whatever, their presence. And so it used to happen like that with Lama Yeshe, that the kids would run. You know, if he was coming down the stairs, and because he was, for them, he was, but not with Westerners so much. Westerners was the opposite. He knew that Westerners, what we needed was we needed an example of love and possibility. I really believe that that's why he manifested that way. People ask him sometimes, why are you so wrathful with Karuna? A friend of mine asked him, and why are you not wrathful with me? This one from John Landau asked him once, you know. And he said, well, it wouldn't do any good for you. You don't need it. So you see, it's not what we do, it's the motivation which we do it with. And we talked about that a little bit last night. Okay, so in the morning I was leaving to come back to the States after being there a year and a half. Lama actually invited me to have breakfast with him. I felt very honored. And we had breakfast at the top. And this is 1977, so it was a great breakfast in the sense we had white bread, peanut butter. I hadn't eaten these things for a year and a half. Hard-boiled eggs or eggs, hadn't had much of that. Orange juice out of a can, right? And so, but I was very nervous. He was talking and being pretty casual, and you know, it was like having lunch with I don't know, the president or something, the Pope, I don't know. So he'd be talking. I could hardly eat because I was so nervous. And I had a question for him. Finally, I got the courage up to ask him my question. And the question was, you know, in this little tiny voice that came out. Because I was so nervous, insecure. I said, so now, Lama, well, what should I do? Because I had this year and a half, a remarkable year and a half. And I really wanted to come back, you know. And he looked at me and he scowled. Like, that scowl was an indicator because he did that for the next 8 years for me. You know, I got a lot of scowls. And he scowled and he said, I never tell my students what to do. And I remember he went like that with his hand, you know, kind of dismissed me. I never tell my students what to do. So then I felt like a complete idiot. The next 4 or 5 minutes were very uncomfortable, trying to eat, just sitting there. And then he looked at me and said, so when you come back next year... So yeah, I had to go through the torture part. I want you to teach my young monks. So that's when I came back to the States, finished my degree at Evergreen. And you could only stay in Nepal 3 months in those days. And it's still hard to stay a long time. But if you were a student, you could stay on a renew and, you know, year visa. And so I found a master's program that would, independent master's degree. It's like a miracle. They accepted me. I went back to Nepal and I had the longest master's program anybody in 10 years. They had to stretch out that visa. And so I went back. I initiated the Western Studies program for the kids, the monks there, math, English, Western Studies. In 1988, I came to the States for a meeting. Lama Yeshe had since passed away. And Lama Zopa Rinpoche, I had lunch with him, and he said to me, I think it's time to move back. Meaning here. Hard, very difficult, very difficult. And so he said, it would be good to study psychology. So that leads us to here. I did get a clinical, my degree in clinical psych, and a master's degree, and interned at places like Stanford and all these strange places that are a very medical model. But I did it. Any therapists here, psychologists, social, I know you're a social worker. No? Oh, way back. Yeah. Okay. But you guys are already studying Buddhism a long time, right? Wow. Yeah. So I went to this, I had to work at Stanford, and I was this is early 90s, and I was sort of I was a closet Buddhist. You couldn't be open about it. I didn't feel I could be open in those days. Now you're very lucky. Now it's different. It's kind of cutting edge, isn't it? Yeah. So that's the context for the book. Because I had studied Buddhist psychology for 14 years, came back, and now I had to study modern psychology, sometimes referred to as Western psychology, modern psychology, and it was tough. And I'm going to share that with you. Okay? That is part of the impetus for writing the book and why we're here today. Okay? That's a picture of Lama Yeshe with my mother and my sister. You like that photo better, Donna, of me, than the one I sent you?
And that one's cute, too.
Yeah. I always know if it's pre-1981 or post-1981, because 1981 was the year I got married, and Lama asked me to shave my beard off the night before I got married. I'd already had it for years, you know? It's like, I was saying to Donna today, it's like asking a woman to shave her head, I think. It's like, oh, I broke out in a sweat. Shave my beard? So teach for your mom. So this applies, whether you're new to Buddhism, it's good to hear this now. If you're old to Buddhism, it's good to hear it now. Better if you've heard it before. What Lama Yeshe's, what his mission was, as I said, he was a communicator. He really believed in communication. And, you know, he really said, after teaching us for so long, and he used to say, you need to be able to explain these ideas to your mother. I really took that to heart. That's not easy. And Einstein said, I wish I put his quote up, but Einstein said, if you can't explain a complex idea in simple terms, you don't understand it well enough. Buddhist psychology, philosophy is very complex, isn't it? Some of it. It's tough. I mean, in a sense, it's very deep. I don't want to say very academic, but, you know, it has an academic side to it. Intellectual. It's extremely... And people... I mean... Back when I was in those early days, we didn't have much translations. We were doing them, you know. And I spoke I speak very little to, you know, very poor Tibetan. And so I'd have to listen through translators too. And I'm like, and I was training the translators. That's what my job kind of was, part of my job. And, you know, you'd have this translation going on and he's like, what is the word he's using? What is, you know, I can't remember. Oh, I know it was Adam. I can't pronounce it right. Adamantine. Is that the word? Yeah. Did I say it right? Adamantine. Do you all know what it means? Huh? How many people don't know what adamantine means? Thank you. So my translator, this is a 19, one of the ones I was training. He was translator for this teacher. He's with adamantine. I said, what are you, adamantine? And I debrief with him after. And they finally said, I said, what are you saying? I can't understand. Adamantine. And I said, oh, we don't use that word. I mean, you know. He said, yes, you do. Okay. So I said, no, listen, and yes, you do. You got to understand, Sherpas Tibetans are very strong-minded. So I said, okay. I said, we don't. Yes, you do. Okay. So then he goes, he leaves the room, comes back, and he brings a dictionary. He's been memorizing the dictionary because they memorize texts. Thousands and thousands of pages. And of course, adamantine is an A, so it was one of the earlier words. He'd been memorizing the dictionary. And he says, see, it's right here. I told you you were wrong. I kind of was wrong, right? So teach for your mom, okay? So those of us who've been studying, we need to figure out. I think people get this idea now, but it's pretty revolutionary. With these deep philosophical ideas, still we need to teach them so your mom can understand them. That includes teachings on emptiness, dependent arising, the four schools, all that kind of stuff, which is really complex. So teach for your mom. So that's my, I feel that's my mission. I'm a translator. So some years ago, 6-7 years ago, this is Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Good picture, isn't it? Helmsman. So I was going to open a new office. I live in Santa Cruz. You know, that's about an hour and a half south of San Francisco. And Lama Zopa Rinpoche has a house there. We have a couple Buddhist centers there. And I was going to open a new office. So I asked if he would come and consecrate, you know, the office. That's sort of a Tibetan Buddhist tradition, I guess not just Buddhist, feng shui, that kind of thing. And one of his teachers was visiting in town, Chödön Rinpoche. And so he invited, Chödön Rinpoche doesn't speak any English, and Lama Zopa Rinpoche invited him to come with him to come consecrate my new office. So I was, so we're driving over to this, I'm driving, it was this 10-minute drive. And of course, Lama Zopa Rinpoche is sitting in the back seat because he gave the front seat to his guru. And we're not talking, Rinpoche and I are not talking because it would be disrespectful since Chödön Rinpoche didn't speak English. You know, us to talk away and he sat there. But at one point, from the back seat, out of nowhere, Rinpoche says to me, you know, I'm at this point practicing therapist and quite a while. And he says, you know, if you're just helping people feel better, there's no benefit. And, you know, I talk about near-death experiences where your life flashes before you. I actually understand that now. It's like I saw every client I ever worked with flash before, you know what I mean? Just kind of, not just metaphorically, almost physically. And I had this incredible sinking feeling. I couldn't find one in that split few seconds that I had not just try to help them feel better. Now, I'm not talking that this is a message for every therapist, you know, emergency room nurses, doctors. It's not, that's not the point. This is a message for me, I think. Of course, other people, if they can incorporate it, it'd be good. But what was he saying? If you're just helping people feel better, there's really not much benefit. That's why I put this up. I just like the picture. In other words, hugs are not enough. What do you think he meant? We don't know each other well enough to say. People get nervous. Yeah. You're not nervous, are you? What do you think?
Just
Oops, here you go.
Well, drugs help people feel better.
Right.
I'd say it's more about helping people live better and make better decisions. Something sustainable, kind of like, you know, you give a man a fish. He goes hungry on the morrow. You teach him how to fish, then he doesn't go hungry again.
I think that's exactly what it is. I think and why it had a profound effect on me is because I'd sort of chickened out. You know, let's see, I say this is like 7, 8, 9 years ago. So I'd already, now I've been involved in Buddhism for like over 40 years. So what, after 30 years, I hadn't come to terms with that? Do you know what I mean? So I didn't have the guts. I wasn't doing therapy or teaching. Sometimes I taught these ideas, but it really wasn't my work. Was if someone came in my office, whatever problem, you know, I mean, it's all problems. My focus would go to wanting them to feel better, no doubt. You know, I've noticed when people have students of Rinpoche or Lama Yeshe, when they're having emotional problems or something struggling with, I notice that they'll meet with Rinpoche. They don't always come out feeling better. It could happen. I mean, you feel better, you feel hopeful maybe. But they don't necessarily target what you're feeling right then. They teach you how to fish. Besides, what's coming up right then is coming up right then. You know, it's already, the popcorn is popped already. You can't unpop it. We'll talk about that. So again, for us, what does this mean for us? Those of us who've been studying these ideas, those of us who are beginning or new, those of us who maybe don't, what does that mean for us? For me, what it meant was, well, actually, in this honest truth, my wife says, if I tell you the honest truth, and I always say to her, is there anything else? Do people say that, honest truth?
Yeah.
Well, if I tell you the dishonest truth, we joke about that. And does that mean you're sometimes not telling me the honest truth? So, honestly, I felt like turning the car around. I felt, I'm done. I'm done. I'm not going to do this work. I've just blown it. I mean, I felt ashamed, kind of. You know, I'd done this, and I didn't have the guts to do it. You know, what it means is I had studied a lot, done a few retreats, you know, and that sort of thing. I immersed myself in this, and I wasn't speaking from the principles that I had studied and believe in. And that's interesting. And maybe that's just a personal thing. Maybe for other people that they wouldn't, you know, they would be more authentic. For me, as I guess I kind of chickened out. You know, I cared about offending people or alienating or having them walk out of my office, or maybe I felt I didn't know how to do it, you know, without tactfully. Okay. Remember, teach for your mom means there's some tact too. Okay. So that's my story, you know, on that. I think that's all the history part. I've caught you up to speed. It did take 30 minutes. But it's also context. You know, I don't think we should give our ideas, should is not the right word. I think it's helpful when you're expressing ideas to give context, right? I think context is everything. You need to situate your eyes. And this is one of the things I learned in as a practicing therapist. When I got involved in therapy and studying, it is an interesting point, is that I, you know, as a Buddhist student of psychology, and then going into the university or the college, in the university and studying object relations and psychodynamic theory and family systems and alcohol and recovery theory, right? I was like, oh my God, this stuff is nonsense. Sorry. I mean, it's not, but that's how I felt. I felt, you know, not that you can't help people with that. I meant as a theory. They all disagreed with, no one agreed with each other. There wasn't a unified theory. That was disturbing to me because you don't find that in Buddhism. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. So I was really, in a little bit of, crisis. It's like when I get out of school, I gotta take that board exam, right? State exam. What am I gonna do? Well, there are some really refreshing ideas that were then. That's a long time ago, and there's more now. But back then, the idea of constructivist theory. Does anyone know about constructivism? Do you Do you study it? Is it still popular? Yeah? Yeah. It's refreshing, isn't it? In terms of a Buddhist. He's not sure. Karen, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, because constructivist theory, well, it's a bit shallow for a Buddhist. Because the Buddhists, we also, our foundation is constructivism. But it's much deeper explanation of constructivism than what's presented, you know, in the Western modern idea of constructivism. But it gives you a language. And I thought, oh wow, look at this. This is pretty good. And there's some therapies that arose out of constructivism, one of which was narrative therapy. And narrative therapy mostly. So that gave me a language, it gave me some hope. At least I had something that I found very fascinating and interesting. It was not contradictory to Buddhist psychology, except for one thing. Narrative therapy, and I think constructivists as a whole, believe that the approach should be anti-psychology. In other words, they say that they feel that you should approach problems without a psychology. That when they talk about constructivism, they say that problems are socially constructed. Make sense? Socially constructed, culturally constructed. And that has some truth to it. But basically what they say, if you start talking about problems being psychologically constructed, this has been a form of oppression for many, many people, which is another story, but there's truth to that in terms of the psychological culture. We go back to early days of psychology. They felt an imbalance between client and therapist based upon theory. So the expert was the psychologist because he had the theory. And I think you were going to ask me about reframing. That's the problem with reframing. When we reframe, often reframing means you take the expert's understanding of a problem and you substitute your understanding of the problem for their understanding of the problem. It's reframe. That's usually what happens. It doesn't always. David was brought up about reframing earlier. That's a typical therapy intervention, right? Not like it's wrong. It's just you gotta be careful. Okay. So if you do me a favor, and just look at your hand for a second. And just, you know, analyze it, look at it, study it. And then if you tell, so I'm gonna ask you, can you tell me what makes up your hand? Like what makes a hand? Tell me. Someone to say something. Digits, okay. What else? Skin. What else?
Joints.
Tendons, did you say?
Yeah.
Okay, what else?
Thumb.
Yeah?
Muscles.
Keep going, because you could say that still could be a foot.
Fingernails.
Prehensile.
What's that called?
Prehensile.
I always wonder what that word is. What color is it?
Depends.
Okay. Tell me the color of your hand.
Pink.
Okay, pink. Anyone else? Everyone else? Oh, pink? The flesh color, brown, tan, right? What's its texture like?
Wrinkled.
Okay, but you can tell me it, right? Wrinkled. Okay. And is it hard, soft?
Both.
Kind of soft. Yeah.
Knuckles are hard.
And what's inside of the hand? Blood, veins, a capillary is in your hand?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Muscles.
Right. Okay. Anything else someone wants to say about their hand? How long have you known your hand?
42 years.
62 years, whatever. Right, kind of your whole life, right? 10 minutes. Okay. Don't answer this question. Just think about it. What is your mind? What color is it? Does it have a color or not? Don't answer. Just think about it. Does it have a shape? What shape is it? We know this is digital, 5 digits for the most part. Were you taught in school what your mind was? Did your parents teach you what your mind was? Did the doctor teach you? The TV teach? How do we know our hand? We had a lot of familiarity with our hand, don't we? But the mind? Now, I think you'll agree with me. You've probably had your mind as long as you've had your hand. At least as long, right? Does anyone find it unusual that we don't have... I mean, we're in a little bit of a unique environment here because it is one of our topics. But just put yourself out in the world in general. You know, if you ask your parents, hey, dad, mom, what's the mind? Okay? Or you ask your coworkers. They couldn't answer, could they? I think that's strange. If you really think about it, that is pretty alarming. Because it's at least 50% of who we are, maybe more. Maybe, you know what I mean? We have a body, we have a mind. We can talk about the body quite a bit. I mean, not quite a bit, a lot. But the mind? Now, here it gets even worse. Okay, this is where I get on my soapbox. I have soapboxes. I know, I guess... Maybe everyone has soapboxes, I don't know. One of my soapboxes is this psychology thing. Because unfortunately there are not more psychologists or psychotherapists in this room, because it's really embarrassing. You go and study psychology. Now look at, so I'm a psychotherapist. I could say I'm a psychologist. In California I can't say I'm a psychologist because I only have a master's degree. I wonder if I could say I'm a Buddhist psychologist. I have to look that one up. Any lawyers here? No? No California law? So look it. So this is really, I mean, seriously, I'm not trying to exaggerate. It really does bother me that people are psychologists, psychotherapists, whatever. Even social workers, you have a background in psychology, right? So, So the word comes from psyche, right? Which means here the human soul, spirit, or mind. Ology is a study thereof, or an ologist is one who engages in the study of the psyche. Okay. So again, say the human soul, spirit, and then therapy. It's a treatment of disease or disorder by some remedial, rehabilitative, or curative process of the psyche. Correct? It's not therapist, not the therapist of the hand. Okay, it's a therapist of the psyche. Correct? You with me? Okay, it's pretty simple. Now, therapist is that person that, okay, now. This is where my soapbox, this is where I get on my soapbox. Unfortunately, we only have 3 or 4 people who say, so in the people here who studied psychology, or maybe other people studied psychology, in your study of psychology, did you ever receive a definition of the mind? I already know the answer. Can you imagine being a heart surgeon and you don't know what a heart is? Everyone agrees on what the heart is. I think if you're a heart surgeon, people agree. You know, if you're a mechanic, and you work on internal combustion engines, you're going to have agreement with it. Now, there's different kinds, but you know what? You got to know what it is, right? Before you're going to, take it apart. You got to know what the heart is, right? But if you ask, I'm serious, you know Dan Siegel, some of you know Dan Siegel. He's not actually a neuroscientist. Did you know he's not a neuroscientist, David? He's actually a psychologist who studies neuroscience. He's one of the leading researchers in neuroscience. And I did this, long before he did, but he's more famous. So he said a couple months, like last year, I was at one of his workshops, and he brought this up. And I thought, oh, he must have read my book. No, just joking. So he asked in his seminars or his, conferences, he asked that question to people. And this is a room full of psychologists, neuroscientists, psychiatrists, and also teachers, and but he's a mental health professional and he teaches on neuroscience and that sort of thing. And he says that he has roughly asked over 100,000 people. His estimate is that 5% took some class or had some study of the mind itself. And then this gentleman, Dan Siegel, is not a Buddhist. But he did say, my guess is most of those 5% were Buddhists. So now, I mean, think about this. So if you ask, you should be able to ask, you know, you go in, see a therapist, and he says, yeah, I'm a psychotherapist, I'm a psychologist, and you're great. I'd like to work with you. Good. But one thing is, you're a psychologist, you're a studier of the mind. Can you just tell me what the mind is? You'll throw him right off his seat. Try it. Now, people have some answers, but you know, because I studied a long time in Nepal, and I think other people will attest that. If you're a Buddhist in this tradition, you study, don't we? I mean, it's a big part of, you know, knowledge is a very important part of meditation. So, did you know? Like I know I can ask people in this room who studied what the mind is, and they'll be able to say, and they're not even psychologists. Did you know that if you go to, Buddhism, you know, it's gone as far south as Sri Lanka, as far north as Russia, as far west as Afghanistan, maybe even further, as far east as, you know, Japan and Indonesia. If you sat down with any scholar, Buddhist scholar from any of those countries, China, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, if you sat down, now it might not be just a lay person, but any scholar or expert in Buddhism, of which many of them are, and you said any one of those countries, ask them, can you just tell me what the mind is? Do you know they'll be able to tell you? Do you know that they will tell you almost the same thing in each of those countries? It might be small differences, but not significant differences. That's amazing. Do you know if you go to Stanford and you talk to the behavior psychologist and ask what the mind is, he doesn't know, or he has an answer. You go across the hallway and you talk to the psychodynamic guy, and you ask him what the mind is, and he'll tell you something different. And then you go to the neuroscientist, and you ask him, no one agrees. But it's a new science, right? Psychology is a very new science in modern culture. So maybe another 10, 20, 30 years, maybe there will be an agreed-upon definition. But it's certainly scary to me. Anyone else alarmed by that, or is it just me? Am I just hung up? Anyone else find it alarming? It is, you know, especially when you go to a therapist, you get better. Anyway, I think maybe I'm just too hung up on it.
Dave, can I say something?
Yeah. But I can't show the slide then.
Sorry, go ahead.
No.
Well, two things. First of all, Fritz Perls in the 70s said, no one comes into therapy to get better. They only come into therapy to get more comfortable.
But that was my problem, right?
No. I mean, he said, you know, that...
Why didn't I hear that?
And he says that one of the challenges of doing any kind of work with people is that it's an act of collusion.
Mm-hmm, yes.
But...
that was one thing. Number two?
The other thing about what is mind is I think there's some assumptions that are so unconscious.
Yeah.
In the sense that we all assume that we all know what we're talking about when we say the mind.
Yes.
And I think it crosses many disciplines, even supposedly the most rigorous.
Mm-hmm.
So I
agree.
I think
that's good. It's a good point. And often
that's one of the things I think Buddhism does, is it keeps challenging the assumptions at more and more levels.
It's very rigorous. Yeah. Buddhism is very rigorous. Everything has a definition. We have no definition. Yeah. And I will get into the Buddhist mind part as we go on.
Okay.
Were you going to ask Were you going to ask, what do Buddhists say the mind is?
Yes, I was going to ask
I knew
definition.
That, see? I will tell you on Sunday. No, I'm joking. I want to ask a question, just in light of what you were saying about the mind. I want to ask, just go back for a second. You know, when you heard about Buddhism, I mean, how old were you? You remember when you first had a memory?
19.
And what was told to you about Buddhism was, or what image did you make of what Buddhism is?
I've taken a class in college,
uh-huh.
And it was religion and ecology or something like that.
Oh.
So we read a Thich Nhat Hanh book, and
uh-huh.
I got the sense that it was just about a practice of being calm. It was just all about breathing,
yeah.
I thought.
Okay, that's
and being connected to nature, which, you know, that makes a lot of sense
okay.
for that.
Yeah.
So I thought it was...
about peace and calmness.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
How about other people? Thanks. How old were...
17,
really? Yeah. You guys were old when you first like heard about it. what was your image when it came up?
Well, most of the time it was obviously about suffering and the cyclic circle of death, rebirth, old age, and rebirth.
And what was your what kind of image did you make? Did it make sense to you? Did it? What was your like image of it?
As an upcoming spiritualist, when I was younger, I was a spiritualist, so I came into Buddhism with an open mind already.
Oh, okay.
So it wasn't as foreign as most people, but it was like suffering, that's all we're talking
right.
about. But obviously, rigorously studying, it's become a lot more opening and
yeah.
you know what you're talking about now.
So you guys are lucky, you two. How about other people?
Yeah.
You know, I say lucky. I mean, mine was like, oh, no, don't tell my mind. What, anyone else?
Kung Fu,
that was mine too. Someone in the back?
I had National Geographic and Able Research. And so I
wait for the mic.
Because we're streaming, so they can't hear me.
All right.
I always had National Geographic magazines even when I was very young. And so I would have seen pictures in there and thought it was very colorful and exotic.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Someone else? One more?
Thomas Merton in the 60s.
You got a mic?
Sorry, your mic.
Okay. I'll tell you what mine was. Because I remember my parents, they traveled a lot. And I don't know how old I was, 8, 9, 10 or something. And they brought back a little, they were in Cambodia or somewhere, and they brought back one of those little black fat Buddhas. And they told me, like, you rub his stomach and make a wish. And then it was Kung Fu after that, the show Kung Fu. Yeah, so that's why, the reason I probably would ask that maybe 10, 15 minutes ago, because, you know, maybe the myth of Buddhism is not so big anymore around, because it's been much more open, much more prevalent. But generally people, you know, some audiences that I work with, it's, you know, it's like the Buddha that you rub his stomach with or something. And they don't really... Or, you know, the thing I get the most... Well, I make a lot of confessions, you guys, okay? So, like, you know, be kind. So, I'm going to get it out right now. I have a vice. I only have one, I don't know. I play golf. Okay? That's the truth of the matter. And, you know, if you play golf... people get angry when they play golf. So it's so like looks so peaceful and stuff, and people get really. And so if I get a little upset, it's terrible. Don't write a book, okay, about Buddhism or anything. Or don't, because people say, "Hey, I thought you were supposed to be like mellow." It's like they don't get it. You know, I have problems too. You know, this idea of Buddhism is, you know, Buddha's not a practicing Buddhist. Neither is Lama Yeshe, Lama Zopa. They're done, in a sense. You know, there's... Anyway, so, yeah, I always thought this is a peaceful thing. And In fact, my publisher said that to me once, where he made some, my editor, he made a big mistake on something, I can't remember what it was. And so I was just being really strong with him. I wasn't angry. He said, God, you know, wow, that doesn't sound very Buddhist to me. Oh, no, you know, you got to be, it's not about, well, fortunately, yeah, he will learn. It's not just, it's about being helpful, not about being peaceful. Peaceful is usually helpful, though. Okay. We don't need to take a break because we're only going to 8:30, right? Okay. So I think this is a pretty unusual, pretty provocative saying. Dharmapada is when we see, have the this kind of quote. This is an actual quote from the Buddha himself. So when we study Buddhism, we're either studying Buddha's exact words, which are the sutras, or we're often studying commentaries to those sutras. Okay. Buddha himself taught what was captured from what he taught is 100 volumes long. And I remember doing a little bit of study on how long would it take. Because in the monasteries, they recite many, many pages of text or of prayers. And they actually recite all this, the entire canon. And those 100 volumes, I want you to do a little research. How long would it take to recite them? So when we talk about volumes, we're talking like the Bible's one volume, and it would take, I don't know how long it would take to recite that out loud, probably maybe a day. Yeah. These more than a day? Well, you got to remember, these guys are fast.
The entire Bible is about 1,000 pages long.
1,000 pages, okay. I wonder how long it would take if you had it memorized. It is small. Well, these monks or nuns, they recite very fast. This sutra is very, very fast. And I calculated it would take about 40 days, day and night, 24 hours. So it's a lot of text that they captured that Buddha spoke. Maybe that's wrong. So everything has mind in the lead, has mind in the forefront, is made by mind. If one speaks or acts with a corrupt mind, misery will follow as the wheel of a cart follows the foot of an ox. Foot of the ox. Then there's more to the quote where it says, everything has mind, the lead has mind, and the forefront is made by mind. If one speaks with a wholesome mind, then happiness will follow. It's a blah, blah, like that. But the point here, why I say this is provocative? Everything has mind in the lead, has mind in the forefront, is made by mind. Okay? When you have a problem with someone else, do you think this is made by my mind? When you look at the political campaign and all the conflict and the negativity, do you think, oh, this is just made by the mind? When you see a polluted city, when you come through this traffic for the fair and you get stuck, do you think this is just made by the mind? I don't think we do. We see climate change and you get your blood boiling. Do you think, oh, this is made by the mind? We don't, I don't think. Do you? I don't. You do. Yeah, because you're trained. You're trained. As you train, you know, you begin. Now, we could go into that. There's one thing about believing it's made by the mind. That's a good step. That's huge. The next thing is actually perceiving, having that ongoing developed perception. That's called perceiving reality. Okay, which we're going to talk about quite a bit. But just in general, you know, if you talk to people and, I mean, it's fascinating. I think as a Buddhist, the main thing that we're doing differently is that when we go through life and we go through our problems, we go through our relationships and we go through our sickness and we go through our ills and we go through our pains and we go through our depression and we go through our sadness and we go through our anxiety and we go through our fears and we go through poverty and we go through not enough resources and we go through not getting what we want and then we get what we don't want. We're just sort of whipsawed around. And if you're like me, for the most part, we don't connect with that mental part. It's created by the mind. Can you believe that? I mean, can you believe if we really dealt with climate change or this ridiculous campaign from the point of view it's created by mind? I mean, what if you just start, like tonight when you go home and you see or tomorrow, and you see the unending comments about this campaign. And you look at, you know, so what we do is we look at let's say we're reading a paper or watch TV. You look at it and you say, God, can you believe, right? You don't say, oh, wow, this is all mental. I hope you do. If you say that, you're probably not in this class, but maybe. And there's different gradations of that. Some people are just getting that idea. Some people are like more developed it, you know, more familiar with it. Some people, like Lama Zopa Rinpoche, is always in that, or the Dalai Lama. Okay, that's what we're talking about. This is all we could talk about. And how that works. That's all that Buddhism is. That's it. Now what comes is, well, yeah, but how do I, and when Robbie's yelling at me, and, right? We come up with all the countless machinations. Is that how you say it? Machinations?
Machinations.
Huh?
Machinations.
No,
M-A-C-H-I-N.
C-H is... How you say it?
Machinations.
I'm not going to use the word. All the different manifestations of every instant that arises, you know? Or you're just sitting here and you had dinner. And you're sitting and you're kind of... Maybe you're getting tired, right? Because the food's digesting. And you say, I got to keep awake. I'm trying to stay awake. I think I'll get some water. But do we think this is all just mentally created? Have you ever approached it from that angle? Have you ever approached your tiredness from purely as a mental creation? Have you ever approached your thirst as a mental creation? Have you ever approached your partner who's telling you never do the dishes right from a mental perspective? Difficult. That's what Buddhism is all about, helping us to decipher all of that and get us to be clearer in what reality is. That's all. You know, Buddhist psychology is nothing more. Buddhism is nothing more than getting us in touch with reality. Okay? And then what we do with that. Get in touch, and then what we do. But then, how do we get in touch? We have 84,000 different teachings on that. 100 volumes, 84,000 different instructions, explanations on reality, on how to understand reality. I don't think there's many other systems of thought. I mean, is it a religion then? Is that a religion? Is it a science? Is it a psychology? It's interesting, isn't it, to think about it. What is a religion? What's a religion? I didn't ask you what the mind was. So this is an easier question. Anybody want to take a belief system? Okay. Why is it? Why do religions exist? You guys,
explain unknown things.
To explain and know things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, belief system. Is a belief system a way of explaining and knowing things? Are they related?
Yeah. Dogma.
Dogmas, yeah. But we could use dogma as a neutral term. Usually it means something, we say a negative. I don't know if you meant a negative, but dogma, no. Okay. So dogma is what an explanation, I guess. What does dogma mean?
Set of teachings that are expected to be believed.
And why are religions? Why do they exist?
Ostensibly.
ostensibly to provide a moral code and probably to explain things that need to be explained.
Yeah, that's kind of what you were saying in the back. And so I guess people have a curiosity. Yeah. Religion is something about, also has some sort of organization, organizing principle, right? It's an organizing principle. So it's hard to know whether Buddhism is a religion or not. Why do we say it's, why could we say it's not a religion? Could we? Huh?
His Holiness says it's not. Compassion is not a religion.
Right.
There's no supernatural.
So is religion having to do with...
Creator God. No creator God.
Faith-based? Does it have to do with faith-based explanation? Okay. Well, let's agree on that for the moment. So we'll... Otherwise, I'm going to be here and just not get past the... what slide am I on? 10. How many think I have?
12.
84,000.
84,000. There you go. Have you ever heard any religion say this? If science proves some belief of Buddhism wrong, then Buddhism will have to change. I think that's an amazing, amazing saying. Has this already happened? Does anybody know? Because His Holiness spends a lot of time collaborating with scientists. Anyone aware of any changes that Buddhism has made as a result of scientific discussion?
The cosmology.
The Dalai Lama has spoken about the cosmology.
Right. That's one thing. That's right. So traditionally in Buddhist, traditional culture, part of the cosmology is there's the flat earth, for example. And His Holiness said we have to stop teaching that. Because science has proven the earth's not flat. There's a few other things like that. So that's pretty amazing for a spiritual leader to say that. And that's pretty gutsy. I will say one thing that's interesting. What I've seen that His Holiness or others have like dismissed, you know, the traditional Buddhist ideas, none of them yet were what Buddha taught. So that's interesting. They're all come from the commentaries. Yeah, it's interesting. We could research that more. I'd love someone to tell me whether that's true, but that's what I've seen so far. For example, I don't think Buddha must not have taught the world is flat, maybe. That came later in the cosmologists. I think a lot of the cosmology was around before Buddhism. It was Vedantic. So, okay, so that's pretty cool. Yeah, that's very cool. That means we have to we're allowed to question. Yes, that's big. Because I think when faith-based systems of thought, I guess it's faith. You're not really supposed to question, which is understandable. Okay. I think everything probably, yeah, maybe everything we could say is designed to make a better world. And then we get personal. I think they're all designed to help people be happier. Can you think of anything that was designed that people are engaged in that to not make them happier? I think that's a fundamental drive of every sentient, probably every, I'll make bold, every living sentient being, its drive is to be happy, not to suffer, not to be in pain. Okay? I know many people hear that, but if you think about it, like even like a cockroach. I mean, a cockroach, when you turn out the light, turn on the light, it runs. Why? It runs and hides. It has fear. Now, I don't speak cockroach, so I'm not 100% sure. I had someone question me because I was talking about chipmunk once. And I was talking about, well, I wouldn't want to be a chipmunk. You know, I think that, you know, even chipmunks, their goal is to be happy. But I was saying that I think there's a lot of suffering in being a chipmunk. And this guy said, well, how do you know? And I said, well, I guess I don't, but you look at a chipmunk, it's very, you know, anxious and it's always like on edge. And he said, well, maybe it's just, you know, having fun that way. What do you do? Okay, you do make assumptions. You got okay. I agree. But you know, it's not that big of a stretch. I mean, any animal, if you threaten it, you know, even barnacles, you know, you touch it and they close up. Now, some scientists would say, well, you're just making assumptions. It's just a reaction. You know, it's just a, what do they call that? Reaction. It's just a reflex. Thank you. I don't believe that's true, but I can't say for sure. But if it's not a reflex, if there's something there, then it feels threatened. And then, okay, so maybe barnacle, they say you can't say there's something there. But what's the difference between a barnacle and a chipmunk? It's not that big of a difference. You can tell me chipmunk is just reflex? I mean, it's pretty easy to see a chipmunk has a sense of self. I'm extrapolating, I'm assuming, but I don't think it's that. I mean, you have to be pretty blind not to see that. You know, sometimes you turn on the TV, you see those hunting shows. Yeah, and I watch them sometimes. You know, I'm really curious how do you hunt and kill an elk? How do you do that? Yeah, and then I discovered that. Well, you objectify the thing and you assume it has no sentience. That's how you can kill them. Yeah. But a lot of those hunters, funny, especially the ones that hunt the bow and arrow, they're somehow, if you look at their belief system, they hunt with bow and arrow because they don't say it, but it's because they believe the animal has is a sentient being and that it's only fair to hunt it with a bow and arrow. It levels the playing field. And then sometimes when they hunt it and they kill it, then they'll do some like prayer over it. They'll apologize. Have you seen anyone else seen this?
Yeah.
The only way you could do that is because you think it's a sentient being. And it seems, I believe, you can prove me wrong, I believe that we're born that way and then we learn not to see them as sentient. You know, we should have talked about that last night in our parenting thing, but I don't think it needs to. But I think that inherently, maybe inherently is not the right word, but you know, by nature, I think humans do get the sense that these are living beings that feel pain. So how did I go off on that? Sorry, it's a soapbox, I guess. So point is, so then we think about okay. So for ourselves, let's talk about human beings. So do you think? Do you think that if you're like me, do you think that your day and moments are spent seeking happiness or not? Have you seen that? Can you see that? Can you see that anything you do is to be happy? Can you see that? Okay. This is an easy crowd, right? But you think about, you know, explain that to people who didn't ever think of this before. They go, well, I don't know. You know, what's the one that people always come up with? Suicide. Well, that's or people who cut, you know, usually women, girls cut, you know, or harm themselves. You say, see, not everyone's trying to be happy. Why are they doing that? The misunderstanding of what will make them happy. Everyone, no one wants to suffer. We don't know what is the cause of happiness. We don't know what the cause of suffering is. So people, you know, girls or guys too, you know, cut themselves or, you know, do, you know, lots of drugs and do destructive behavior or whatever that. They are trying to be happy. They just don't know the cause. And we all do those things. It's not like, you know, we're not like that. We are. We do destructive things that don't make us happy all the time. All the time. All the time. In fact, most of the things we do probably don't make us happy. But the motivation is to be happy, isn't it? That's our goal. So now let's get clear. What happens in Buddhism? So Buddhism knows that. Buddhist psychology knows that. That's the fundamental. The problem in the world is that so we could actually probably get people to agree on that for the most part, that they want to be happy. And we get psychologists and psychotherapists to agree, yes, people want to be happy, and my job is to help them be happy. But then we have to think, well, what is happiness? I'm not even the cause yet. So what is real happiness? And so it sounds like such a trite question, but it's quite profound, isn't it? What really is happiness? you should think about it. I'm sure that people are not answering right now because it's, you know, sometimes intimidating in an audience, in a crowd. But none of that. But we have to think about that anyway every day. What is, and do I really want to be happy? Well, yes, I do. Then why don't I do the things that will make me happy? That's interesting, huh? Because even as, you know, you study this psychology and it says, you know, this will cause you suffering and pain, and we still do it. We're going to get to that, right? There's reasons for that. It's not because we don't want to be happy. It's because of some other things are in operation.
Okay.
Yeah. That's why we go to meditation too, right? That is why we go to therapy, but it's also why we eat ice cream. Oh, you mean to understand it is why we go to yeah. That's why we have therapists. We just got to train therapists in these ideas so they can help people. It's my bias, by the way. You know, maybe they're helping people, and I have it wrong. But according to what I believe, it'd be great if we could help therapists. It's quite fascinating. What's happened in our culture, in the in sort of a evolution, is that we don't have, you know, when probably up to 100 years ago or 200 years ago, or in traditional cultures, when people have problems, where do they go? Family is number one. What's number two?
Pastor, minister,
clergy. You know, and I mean any culture, you know, when you look at, you know, Asia, Buddhist cultures, you know, Middle East and Muslim cultures and something, they go to their religious figures for answers for those kinds of problems. Family is first, though, always, it seems, in most cultures. But what's happening here now? Where do people go? Huh? Therapists. Most first still go to family and friends, then therapists.
Corporate coaches.
Corporate. So, internet. But the thing is, so why don't we... So that's pretty good population to work with, you know, and train and share this psychology. You know, it's just... And by the way... You know, I speak, maybe sometimes I'm negative about therapists. I'm not, actually. It's just the science is young. And we have to try and there's a lot of people in therapists and psychologists interested in Buddhist psychology. It's really, when I was at Stanford, I told you I was a closet Buddhist. I couldn't, but if I was there now, I could share these ideas. They're doing research. There's a happiness project at Stanford. I mean, it's really fantastic what's happening now. For young people who are getting involved, there's a lot you can do. Very, very lucky. It's fantastic. Okay. So mental health is happiness. I would say happiness is mental health. I'm going to put my stake in the ground. Okay? Happiness is mental health. You know, we talk a lot of people have philosophy on happiness. And even if they don't mean to, most people will think the default mode, at least in this culture, and I'm generalizing when I say this culture, I mean, it's hard to, you know, what do I mean, America, or, you know, which culture I mean, middle class culture, upper class culture, what am I talking about? But just generally, you know, just being a bit vague about, generally the culture or the movement these days is happiness. What do you think happiness is? What is most people's philosophy? What's their most default mode? Non-intellectual. If everyone wants to be happy, how are people trying to be happy?
Getting what they want.
Can you put a little more? Yes, that's right. What is it they want?
Money, successful marriage or family, love,
mm-hmm.
Good job, security.
Why? Why those things?
Help.
Huh?
Health.
Well, all the things that we're mentioning, why?
They'll make us happy.
And what is that? So happy is a...
You feel them most immediately.
Huh?
You feel them most immediately.
You feel them most immediately. What do you feel? What's the feeling?
Protected, I think.
Achievement.
Protection.
Yeah.
No suffering.
No suffering. What's the opposite of no suffering?
Pleasure.
Huh?
Pleasure.
Who said that? Yes. That's the word I was looking for.
Pleasure.
Pleasure. Pleasure. So when I say I'm not, and I don't mean that shallow. Can you say shallowly?
Uh-huh.
Trump said bigly. There's no word bigly, by the way. So can I say shallowly? No, thank you. I'll have to go look that up. Remember, I was an English teacher before, so, you know. I couldn't spell, though. I still can't spell. Thank God for spell checkers. If you think, so just for a moment here, so you think about what achievement, health, success, career, if you think just on a very simple way, for the most part, what we're seeking is pleasure. Another way of saying it, what we're seeking feels good. Another way of saying it, what we're seeking is comfort versus discomfort. We'll talk more about this tomorrow. It's very important. And you see, even as Buddhists, you know, been practicing for a long time, we still don't believe it. We still think pleasure is it. We just have different values, you know, different, what do I say, values or not values, different methods of pleasure. So for some people, the pleasure, the highest pleasure for them might be, you know, solving a mathematical equation because they're mathematicians or something. Or the highest level of pleasure, I have clients, have had clients who are entrepreneurs and the buzz of that success. Boy, it's terrible when they fail. But no, entrepreneurs don't fail. That's right. So, did you know that? Any entrepreneurs here? Have you ever had a failure?
All the time.
All the time, but how many? See, all of the time. That's the point. Most entrepreneurs, they say, how many failures do they say an entrepreneur has before success?
Ten.
Ten, seven.
Yeah, ten. At least ten.
At least, yeah. Usually they say seven. But if you ask an entrepreneur how many failures they had, what do they say usually?
None.
Exactly. So none, because it's just a learning experience. It goes to the next success. It just didn't work out. But now it's successful. You know, that way of thinking is actually quite helpful. Why did I bring that up? Oh, so that's the buzz, right? The pleasure. So everyone has different addictions or different attachments to pleasure. You know, some people's pleasure is reading a good book. That's all they need. And then a lot of people, and this is a bit of a tricky one, the pleasure of quietude and meditation. Now, are all pleasures equal? No. Some pleasures are more beneficial than other pleasures. The pleasure of killing is probably worse than the pleasure of reading a good book. Okay? But the philosophy, so we're going down the, it's not the philosophy, but the psychology behind it is still, they're in a way, equally confused. They're equally confused because they still believe that if I just get, well, the person who gets pleasure from a book, what happens when they finish that book? They need another book. Because and the belief system, we have to be very honest with them. The belief system is, I feel good when I'm reading a book. Now I have no book. I feel bad. I'm just, you know, making it gross. I feel bad. So to feel good, I need another book. And then the worst thing is when you start a new book and you don't like it. But it happened, right? Yeah, it's hard to find. Oh, if I could just find a book like, you know, or a TV show. Anybody watch TV here? I do. So I told you I only had one vice, though. I guess I have two. What happens when you run out of a good show to watch? You know, so now Lama Yeshe used to say, and I do want to communicate this, because it might be interesting. Lama Yeshe used to say, no, it's not the pleasure that's the problem. That's good news. You don't have to give up your book. You don't have to give up your food. You don't have to give up your comfortable bed. You don't have to give up your comfortable house. Okay? And I think it's really helpful. Lama Yeshe was very, very much a manifestation of that belief. See, he didn't manifest as a like a yogi. To me, Lama Zoparamushi manifests as a yogi. So there's different manifestations for helping our minds. Okay? And but if you met Lama Yeshe, it was very encouraging. He loved beautiful things. He'd come to the West. He'd come back. He really liked teapots. He'd come back to Koh Phan, and you know, a new teapot or some beautiful like glass vases or glass crystal bowls and or cutlery and not cutlery. What do you call the plates? Is that cutlery?
China.
Is there another word for it?
Dishes.
Cutlery is the thing you cut with. Okay. Cutlery too. I remember he used to say, because he ridiculed me. He said to me, you don't even. And he loved, you know, beautiful tea. He loved and make in certain ways. And he cooked, and he loved beautiful clothes. I'm not saying he overdressed. I mean, but he appreciated clothes. You know, beautiful things. Very, very encouraging to see someone. But you know what he said? He used to say to me, you don't even know how to make a cup of tea. What was he saying? It's because I was unconscious. No awareness. You know, like the tea, Japanese, I think like the Japanese tea ceremony where it originates from. You don't even know how to make a cup of tea. We should learn how to make a cup of tea. What he meant was this pristine awareness. Awareness of the beauty of, and the emptiness of the object. It was beautiful. Appreciating its beauty. But he said, the pleasure is not the problem. It's the attachment. Let's remember that. Now, how easy is it to have lots of to have the most pleasurable thing in what you think is pleasurable in your universe and not have attachment? So, you know, that's the problem. Psychologically, that's the problem, okay? That's the mental disorder. So the good news is you don't have to give up your house, you don't have to give up your wife, you don't have to give up your husband, you don't have to give up your girlfriend, you don't have to give up your children, you don't have to give up your car, you don't have to give up tea, coffee. Do you have Pete's here or no? Pete's? You just have Starbucks or Pete's?
Yeah.
Huh? You do have Pete's, okay.
In the store, you can't not shop.
Oh, they don't shop. It's Pete's shop. Oh, you guys see? It's not lucky. It's much better than Starbucks. More pleasure. So that's, when I talk about pleasure, I want to make a distinction here. Actually, I'll mention it again tomorrow, because we are at 8:30, and I don't want to keep you too long. In Buddhist, but just so it's not left with a wrong idea, in Buddhist practice, we could say, or philosophy or psychology, so there is different levels of practice. It's very important to remember this. The level that Lama Yeshe was talking at, where the pleasure is not the problem, that's a very high level practice. I want to make it clear. It's a very high level practice. And there's a saying, don't put the load of a tzo onto an ox. A tzo is a kind of a yak. What is a yak? And an ox, you know, an ox. I guess tzos could carry much more than oxes. So I got to protect myself, you know, in the sense that I don't want to share a wrong idea. Karun said we can have all the pleasure we want. Just don't get attached. Meaning is, you know, we start at our level, right? We have to take ourselves at our wherever we're at. And you have to be the judge of that. You know, you have to be the judge. You have to be very honest. People are of different kinds of places. They need different kinds of practices. An example I often use is an alcoholic. Okay? If you're trying to become healthy, which we're trying to do using the metaphor of an alcoholic who's, we could say, is sick, then, of course, you know, first thing is don't go into bars. Right? And get all the alcohol out of your house. And don't hang around with alcoholic drinking friends. That is the practice of Buddhism. Okay? Now, does that get rid of your alcoholism? It actually doesn't. Okay? So then you move on, because you're really determined. to be completely free of alcoholism. Okay? So then the next level is, this is tomorrow's slide, but I'll just cover it now. Next level is, okay, I realize that I still have that in there. You know, I have those urges. And so what I think would be good for me to do is, you know, sort of like behavioral therapy, you know, kind of work with those urges. So you might hang around your old friends that drink, but you don't drink. But you watch that. You're being hyper aware of, you can feel it in your... I've actually had this experience, by the way, myself. I'll just be honest, because I told you it's confessional. Because I used to like to smoke weed. And then I quit. And then I wouldn't be around. And then some of my really close friends still using, you know. I mean, nothing. And it was hard. But I wanted my friendships back with them. And then, so I hung out with them. And after a while, the urges went away. You know. And, because at that point, you are opening up to the urges. You're being honest with, you know, you're opening up. Because usually there's fear. Most people have fear, like in AA. Oh, no, you don't go around people, you know. Because they're afraid they're going to be taken over by those urges. Well, and we kind of talk about this sort of Mahayana approach. It's like, no, okay, you're going to be fearless. You're not going to drink. You're not going to give in to those urges. Okay? But you're going to confront them. You got to confront them. They're coming up. Okay? Highest level would be maybe, and I'm not encouraging this, but at least metaphorically, the highest level would be you can drink, but there's no attachment. You're dealing with the sensation of the alcohol that you were so attached to before, and you're transforming it. So that's a very high level. Maybe we won't even get there in our life, right? But I just want to share that there is that level. Lama Yeshe was functioning at that level. I mean, Lama Zopa is at that level, but he manifests differently. But Lama Yeshe, because he wanted us to be, not to be so discouraged and so depressed, that yes, it's not the problem, it's not the pleasure, the problem is the clinging. Okay? Now we have to learn how not to cling. That's our job. I think that's it. 8:35. How'd I do? On time. Pretty on time, huh? Okay. Thank you. Any just quick questions, clarifications need? Want to go home? Okay. So thank you very, very much. What we do traditionally is we have what's called dedication, but I don't want to lay that trip on you. I want to tell you that if you just think for a moment, you know, just let's think for a moment. And you think about medical students. Medical students have a horrible life when they're studying medicine, and they're interns, right, Robbie? Difficult? Huh?
Sometimes.
Yeah, okay, sometimes. But imagine that Robbie, when he's in medical school, was thinking about when he gets out of medical school and what he's going to do. Maybe open a clinic, maybe go work in Asia. You see, that's dedication. So he was dedicating, you understand? He was dedicating his work, his hard times then, for what he wanted to achieve. Okay? It's like investing. So just now, I really appreciate you sat for an hour and a half with me, and blah, blah. Yeah, maybe it was hard for some people, maybe it was easy. So you just think, okay, but I don't just want this, any understanding, any knowledge, any clarity that I generated from this time together, I don't want to just have that moment of clarity and now it's gone. I think what I'll do is, I'm going to use it to pile on to increasing my knowledge, increasing my wisdom, increasing my warm-heartedness, so that I really, really can be a benefit to others, and also to myself, that I'm going to become gradually and continually clearer, kinder, and more positive. Think like that, okay? Dedicate all the energy we put shared together. Okay, thank you very much.